Off the Ball on News Talk 106 to 108.
And we shall wonder if one day our game is played on the other planets. We will have interplanetary competition.
Your job now is to stand by our new manager.
I always said if I was Aladicio, they'd probably say I was more of a tactical genius.
If my granny had balls, he'd be my granddad.
Big Sam Aladicio, that's it.
Over it goes. Aguero gets his goal. Of course he does. He always does these days. There's no stopping him right now, or Manchester City.
Can they have a final ball of quality into the box from Young? Yes, they can. Lukaku is there. Brilliant save. Lukaku follows up. Scores again for Manchester United. And Jose Mourinho has been sent to the stands. Whether or not it was for encroachment into the Southampton technical area. Oh, that is a strange one.
Coutinho for Liverpool. What a goal! What a goal by the Brazilian. Liverpool 2 up. Jamie Vardy has already scored a couple of penalties this season in the Premier League. Vardy smacks it and Mignolet stood his ground and saves.
Knockhart to swing it left-footed or in towards goal. It might come from Gross. He just clips one to the far post, not it into the ground. And it's into the back of the net. And Brighton lead. And it is the striker, Tom Al-Hemed, that puts the home side in front. Brighton 1, Newcastle 0.
Just some snippets from the Premier League weekend that was. Kevin Kilbane is here. Hello.
Hello, Joe.
And Pat Nevin, come in.
Hi there, guys. How you doing?
Listen to that. I could close my eyes. It's like you're right here with us.
Exactly, my eyes. SDN is back. It's great. Can I tell you a wee story about it before you start? They sent somebody around to fix this machine, right? Last week when I was away, and I came back, and it still wasn't working. I was furious. The guy came around this morning, and he said, "Have you plugged it in yet?"
Strongly worded letter.
All there now.
So you were at Southampton 0, Manchester United 1. Kev, I know you watched this game as well. Was it your first time seeing United live, Pat, this season?
It was, yeah. I was kind of really looking forward to it because obviously, you know, they've been playing really well so far. And for the first half, I thought, yeah, I was getting quite excited, particularly by Rashford, the way he was playing. He looks lightning when he gets forward. And, you know, Mkhitaryan was looking lively. And then just as the game went on, particularly the last half hour, I just thought, oh, this is awful. I mean, it was really, I was thinking, okay, so you need to sometimes do this. You need to sometimes defend, don't you? You need to sometimes just throw, you know, every player behind the ball. Do you know how they finished the game? I don't know if you noticed it, Kev. Man United finished the game with three fullbacks, three centre-backs, three sitting midfielders. That's basically nine defenders and Lukaku up the pitch. And as a bit of me, I was thinking, that's so disappointing. And there was a wee rumble with the Man United fans around me. And I was walking back afterwards to the train station. They weren't absolutely delighted, the vast majority of them. But in the end, that's how you win. And that's why I've been banging Man United. You know, they know how to win. Or Jose Mourinho knows how to win.
And, you know, I was actually talking to a few United fans over the week, and they said it's the worst performance under Jose Mourinho as United manager. Now, they had a few last season that actually weren't great. But what changed in the game, Pat, for you then? Because United started well, they got right on the front foot, they were playing some good stuff early on in the game. What actually did change from United's point of view then? Why did he actually go towards that negative approach then?
Oddly enough, not United. Southampton, who were a bit pathetic in the first half. I mean, they've got a lot of players I like. I mean, I'm sure you feel the same. You know, Redmond on the left-hand side, a very, very good player and somebody who can, like, have an effect in any game. And every time he got the ball, he wouldn't go at anybody. I'm watching Bertrand behind him and I'm thinking, you two can play. You two can run. And they were so subdued. And I thought, well, you've got to do something in the second half. And manager's got to change it. Well, obviously, went and had a right good go at the two of them. And right from the start of the second half, they had a go. And instead of Man United, you know, trading punches with them, they just sat further and further and further back. And it's not weird. Like, I'm not going to moan at Man United. I watched Chelsea do exactly the same thing at Southampton last season. And guess what? Chelsea go and win the league. You know, it makes perfect and utter sense. It's just, it was a beautiful sunny day. Man United had a great first half. And you're thinking, this could be fun. And it was sucked out of it. And to be fair, with the chances in the second half, Man United were really lucky, weren't they?
Well, don't mention the sun. So Jose Mourinho was asked why they didn't finish that game well, Pat. Here's what he said.
I think they were really tired. 9 of them, they didn't play midweek. So 9 of them was not even accumulation of fatigue. I think the weather was beautiful. We, even if we train 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, 3 o'clock in Manchester, we don't get this weather. No, it's serious. The last time we had this was in Los Angeles and then in Macedonia. And I think they felt, I saw some players not sharp, you know, great spirit, always trying, but not the same sharpness. So when your opponent is coming with everything at you, you know, let's do it for 10, 15 minutes, and we were solid.
Anything in that?
Oh, we want it to be solid. I can't say that it was that hot. It was kind of nice. It wasn't boiling. Mm. There was a game earlier in the season. There was the Arsenal-Chelsea game. And I was standing by the touchline at the start of that game. I thought, honestly, I could be in the south of Portugal here. Boiling. But it wasn't quite that standard. It was just, you know, I'm not blaming Jose Mourinho for it. He could see his team were beginning to wilt. So what does he do? Try and shout them to keep on closing down or say, OK, let's find another way. And he's brilliant at that. He always has been brilliant at that. We had years watching him do it for Chelsea. We watched him even do it with Real Madrid when they played against Barcelona. Yeah. And, do you know, if you get a 1-0, it's great. Had any of those chances, and there were quite a few of them. I mean, one particular when Romero... He had a right good chance that just bobbled the side of the post. Had any of them gone in, you know, 1-1, and it would have looked like a really, really bad result for Manchester United, but it didn't. So, you know, happy.
This would be a far more worrying result for Manchester United if it was their first game of the season and came on the back of the last number of seasons of similar type performances. But actually, it just shows a certain pragmatism, as you both said, which I'm sure Manchester United would happily like to have in their armoury as well. Before we leave that game, Shane Long led the line.
How did he
get on? How's he looking to you? Because Shane Long hasn't scored in a very long time, and we would quite like him to.
He didn't look as if he was likely to score goals, but then again, he was up against a packed defence. And I have to say, Manchester United in the first half, when they played Fellaini right in front of that back line along with Matic, they were leaving no space whatsoever. And I could understand what Southampton were trying to do. They were trying to play it over the top for him to run onto. Still running, doesn't look as if he's lacking that sort of thing, but goal scoring, it didn't look as if he was going to score. He needed some help up there, and when the help came, it was just far too late. But yeah. I wouldn't worry him. I think he looked okay.
It was the same last week. I saw him at Crystal Palace, full of running, played quite well, actually. He was a good outlet for them, but he didn't look like he was going to get himself into a goal-scoring position to actually get a goal.
He needs somebody else with him. Needs somebody else with him.
Yeah.
Manchester City beat Crystal Palace 5-0. We're still kind of waiting for them to have to grind out results. They're just so good going forward at the moment, Kev. You watched this game. So they went with Emerson in goal, obviously. They'd back four again, Walker, Stones, Otamendi, and Mendy. They had a combination. It was a 4-3-3, it seemed. De Bruyne, Fernandinho sitting, Silva, and then they had Sané, Aguero, and Sterling with Jesus on the bench.
Yeah.
Interestingly, Kenny Cunningham was saying he thinks Sané has to play for them. He's that good now.
Yeah.
And the only way to get Sané in the team is to have one of Aguero or Jesus on the bench.
Yeah, that is the thing. Could he not play? Could he not maybe, the way that they're playing at the moment, maybe the only option for him is to drop Fernandinho and go ultra-attacking? I don't think he's going to do that, because I think that'll really cost City if they come up against a good side. But with Sané's, even last season, the way that City were playing, they'd keep a lot of the ball. They were obviously dominating possession, but they didn't have that little bit of X factor, that player that could have gone past someone and create something. That's what Sané gives you.
Yeah.
Those two in behind, though, De Bruyne and Silva. We spoke about them, Pat, before, haven't we? But sensational again. Just the level of football that they're playing, particularly De Bruyne, it's off the charts at the moment. It really is.
Yeah. What was with De Bruyne at Chelsea, Pat? Sorry to interrupt. I'm just curious about that. Why did Chelsea look at this guy and think, 4 or 5 years down the line, even we don't quite see it?
Right player, wrong time. Right. Nothing more than that. If you look at the players that were around at the time, Chelsea were trying to get a right attacking right winger. I've always felt that's the most difficult position in football.
Pat, sorry, could you make the argument as well? Wrong manager, Jose Mourinho. Could you make that argument as well?
Yeah, but to be honest, the players he had in front of him, Oscar was playing really well. You know, Willian comes in to replace him, and Willian did incredibly well. The next season, Chelsea won the league. So, you know, the man who was the manager, Jose Mourinho at the time, was looking at thinking, right, this is what I need to win the league. Now, he's not thinking 3 or 4 years ahead because he rightly knows he probably won't be there in 3 or 4 years' time. So he hasn't got time to wait. And I don't think he was quite right for that team at the time. Love to have seen him being given chances. But, you know, had he not moved away, he wouldn't have got games every single week and he wouldn't have come on quite as quickly. You know, there's other. Sometimes it happens. It doesn't mean you're a bad player. It doesn't mean you're not a great player. But sometimes there is the right team. And as I say, Chelsea had, what was it, Salah. They had a number of players in that sort of position. They just looked really, really good. Cuadrado was another one they stuck in there. Schürrle was in there. A whole bunch of them in a row, and they never quite got the one that was right. But eventually, you know, they had Willian and they had Hazard and they had Oscar for that little period of time. And to be fair, they were pretty good. So it was the best thing, I think, for De Bruyne to move on. And by the way, just talking about players, man, I know everyone's talking about De Bruyne just now. And yeah, absolutely, he could be the best one for a wee period of time. And then next week it'll be Silva. And then next week it'll be Sané. And then next week it'll be Aguero. And then possibly even Sterling. So it's unbelievable. But the one moment, there's always a wee moment. There was one moment during that game. The goal that, was it Sané who scored? It was chipped over and he
needed Silva, it. Yeah, Silva with the
ding. Silva ball.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, guys. I'm happy you know what you're talking about. That ball was unbelievable.
Yeah.
The way he wrapped his foot, and honestly, I just didn't get how he would have considered that ball and how he managed to do it. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, that was Sané's 5th goal in 7 games, Silva with the dink. And then, and this was very prescient given the conversation we had last week, Sterling got on the end of a Sané cross, and then for the next goal, Sterling, his 5th goal in his last 4 games, Aguero with the assist after a De Bruyne cross. It was Sterling again in the right place at the right time. So this really interesting point where we kind of left you on this point last week, where you said that Pep was improving Sterling as a player, predominantly Sterling's game intelligence. And here's the point I want to tease out with you guys, because take the Theo Walcott example. There is a received wisdom in football, which I would have subscribed to, having not watched it for however many years, that you can't teach players game intelligence. Mm. Some players, not least the speedy wingers who've relied on pace all their lives, just don't have it, just don't see it. It's impossible to get inside their heads and make them see the game. And I'm wondering if Sterling is going to prove me wrong or prove that general point wrong. So I wanted to open that up to both of you, because I am sure you've played with players and you've been on the pitch and you've got to know them so well, you've thought, he doesn't see me, he's not going to see me, he'll never see me in a million years.
Yes, 100%. Do you know, I was talking to Jan Mulby the other day about a kind of similar point about a different player, then the name of the player is not important. And you've gone into, you know, a professional level, a top level team, and training after 2 training sessions, if you've not got a level of that, everyone's looking around going, oh my goodness, what? You know, it really sticks out in training. And I would suggest that Sterling, to some degree, was a bit like that for a period of time. I can't really, off the top of my head, remember anyone who suddenly developed it, you know, mid-career. That sort of game awareness that I was speaking about last week, that I never seen in him. I've been watching for it. I wanted to see it happening. I wanted to see it with Walcott and one or two others. But you generally, you're hoping against hope and just think, oh, forget it. That's the thing. Pep doesn't forget it. He thinks, right, okay. And it's the weird thing, Kev, you'll know this yourself. How many times you play little box games and little, you know, 3v2s or 5v2s or whatever, it's to go and develop that.
Yeah.
But the ones that ain't got it kind of never really get it, do they?
Yeah, I know, it's true. And the one thing, what I'm noticing though with Sterling Patterson, I was just chatting to Joe about it earlier on, we saw him play for Liverpool and we saw him get so many one-on-ones, getting himself in positions, coming in from wider areas now. But the one thing you'll see him now, the goal scoring positions that he's actually getting into, he's on the end of crosses, he's on the end of passes. How often when you watch Sterling over the years, he'd stay wide. He wouldn't have the know-how to get himself right between the two centre-halves, get himself in the middle of the goals to get in the goal scoring position. He never did it. He'd always hang fire, always wanted to get it to his feet, thinking he could have maybe manipulated the ball, got himself in a bit of freedom by beating a man. He doesn't do that now. I think his movement off the ball is the one notable thing I think he's proved on. It's marked improvement in the last year, 18 months.
Yeah.
And if we look at him, how he's developed that, that's simply down to one man. It has to be down to Pep Guardiola with what he's done with him.
Yeah. I mean, the argument just now, the discussion with a couple of people this week has been his treatment of Aguero over the past while. You know, he didn't seem to fancy Aguero. You know, he was dropping him and things like that. And it was nothing got to do with that. It's got to do with the fact that, hey, you need to be part of the team. You need to be part of what we're trying to structure here. And if you're like one great player and you're scoring 25 goals a season, but you could be even better scoring 25 or 30, and you could be creating as well, I want to see that. Mm. And, you know, it's back to that. I mean, I've said it for a few weeks now. You know, Pep Guardiola takes incredibly good players and thinks, you ain't good enough.
Yeah.
You can be better than that. And I just don't know anybody else that kind of does it to that level. I've never really known.
It's interesting one on Aguero, though, as well. I mean, I don't have the stats in front of me, but I think three assists now he's got this season that I can just think of the top of my head. He set Jesus up for two. He set up Sterling at the weekend. I don't remember Aguero creating that many. I don't remember him always being that man that was that link man as well so often. He was always the player that, with his movement, he's excellent anyway. But I don't remember seeing that too much from him. It's a great point that on him, that he has actually developed his game. I mean, we'll see how long it's going to go. We'll see if they can carry it right through. But they look electric at the moment. They really do.
It'll be interesting to see how far he can take Sterling, in this case, the Walcott-type player. And how much of a footballer he can turn him into, how much of how much vision he'll actually get. Like, you feel he'll get 70-80% of the way. There'll still be a chink or a deficiency there, but I'm really looking forward to seeing where Sterling gets to in that aspect of his game.
I'd be absolutely gutted if he sold Sterling. Say he has to go and get in, you know, he's going to Arsenal, he wants to get Sanchez from Arsenal, and if he had to trade out Sterling, he probably would. And I would be really disappointed for Sterling for that, because he is going to be better and better and better. And that's why I name all those players that can be the best player on the pitch for them and can be absolutely incredible, and everyone's talking about them afterwards. And I'm sticking Sterling in there now. And I wouldn't have considered doing that before. I really wouldn't have considered doing that before this season. But I'm beginning to think he could be. And, you know, things can change. You know, managers can see that and think, actually, I would have sold you at the start of the season, but you're taking it on and you're adding something as well. And remember, he's always got that burning pace. So, hey, you've got that backup whenever you want it. By the way, the going inside thing, it kind of helps when you've got Walker on one side hammering down and Mendy on the other side. There's no need to stay it wide. It's just going hammer in the middle. He'll be okay.
Yeah. And then you've got a bit of quality inside that can pick the pass out as well, haven't you?
Yeah.
Just a little bit.
Yeah.
We quite like them, don't we?
Yeah. It must be one of the really lovely things for you guys to have played with really intelligent footballers. Steven Gerrard talked about when Xabi Alonso arrived at the club in his autobiography, and he said, you know, first training session, within two or three phases of play, he was like, oh my God, this guy's so intelligent, you know? Yeah. And it, like, you're on a pitch with so many intelligent players. I would say, and I think, I guess my point is, do you have to be on a pitch to fully understand it? But I would think when you're on a pitch, you have a total appreciation for how intelligent each of your teammates is and what they can see, and you work around that. And it's something that is probably hard to communicate with the wider world. They can see it to a point with a lot of players. They can see it when De Bruyne is exceptional and somebody not so good. But I would think you calibrate very quickly when you're on a pitch with people.
It's true. I mean, I think sometimes as well, it's some players need to scream, shout, talk, whatever it would be.
Yeah.
But that sort of thing, it's just instinctive, and it's almost because you've worked on the training ground, because you've played with each other so often, you're making your run, someone's picking you out, you're coming inside, someone's able to, it's almost telepathic, it is.
Yeah.
And it just happens, and it continues to happen, and the opposition can't stop it, because it's almost as if they're structured and they're set up in a certain way, just trying to prevent the most natural thing. Whereas you doing a certain run, you might have worked on it in training, you might not have done, but it's just that natural thing that just happens.
Mm.
Do you know, you mentioned you played with all these players. There's not that many.
Yeah.
There really isn't. I look through my career. I mean, things have moved on. We've got a lot of top international players of come in, and you get more of those types of players now. But I can remember my first training session with Peter Beardsley when he came to Everton. I thought, well, I'm going to try and stay here as long as I can because I want to work with him every single day. But, you know, you look through it and think, how many were really like that? Well, I mean, I had a weird understanding with John Collins, oddly, when I was playing for Scotland. And it's sometimes it's players you don't expect, you know, it's, and from the outside. And even back in when I was playing, those players were sometimes slightly sneered at a wee bit. And I've talked to you before about Peter Beasley, you know, that you look back at all these English centre forwards and they all talk about them. And I'm thinking, yeah, well, Beasley was better than them all, you know, as an actual footballer. But in actual fact, there's more of them around now. We take them for granted now. You know, Manchester City have got 3, 4, 5, 6 of them. But to be fair, you look around, there's not actually that many at that level. And when you get to play with those guys, it is fantastic. It is an absolute joy. You know, and you're gutted when you can't play with them anymore.
I think so. Yeah. Was there anyone for you, Kev, that stood out in your career that you just had a connection with?
Probably the one I had with combination-wise, maybe down the left and side, more so that pass appreciation with someone like Ian Hart. Harty, we know Harty wasn't the sort of quickest player, but his left foot was that where he'd shape it, he'd know when to give it you, predominantly as a wide man in front of him as well. You'd always want it from your fullback first option, try to give it to you, but Harty had a way of being able to find a striker's feet, whether it was into the midfield man inside him, whether it was a ball in behind. He had that real knack of being able to pick that perfect pass the whole time. He did. I mean, we know he had an incredible left foot, but he was a player that I liked playing in front of. And it wasn't so much a communication thing as well. It was just natural. You knew where to make your run because he'd give you that ball.
Yeah, one of the more enjoyable things, I'm sure, about playing in a good team. Lads, we're pretty much done, unless there's any final points you wanted to... I mean, okay, we can't do this every week.
Can I mention one thing to you?
Yeah, go on.
Last week we were chatting, a couple of weeks ago, we were chatting about the centre forwards, and I claimed that I felt that if you have a choice between Diego Costa and Lukaku and Morata, I'd take Morata. I'd have to say, I think I've got a better stick for it.
Yeah, but you've read Joel's mind there. Joel was actually just going to bring that point up to you there. Yeah.
Kev, we were going through what we'll talk about, and Kev said, can we talk about Morata? And I said, we can't keep talking about Morata.
But he keeps on getting better.
Yeah.
The weekend, brilliant.
You can now see it, can't you?
Yeah.
It's clear, isn't
pretty
it?
Good. Is he very fast, or is Darren Fletcher just painfully slow?
No, weirdly, it was a real shock. It was the first game at Wembley playing against Spurs, actually. Went off the left-hand side. And there was an audible gasp by everybody around me. Went, he's quick as well.
Okay.
So, yes, he is actually quite speedy, yeah.
Okay. Pat, pleasure. Thanks so much.
As ever.
Cheers. Well done. Cheers, Pat.
Pat and Evan there. Arsenal 2-0 up now.
Oof. Yeah, I didn't see the goal yet. I'm expecting you to get Lacazette again.
Penalty.
Right, fair play.
And Oisin Langan, Cork, will have to hold the party. A pity. I mean, I guess they would have loved to do this at Turner's Cross under the lights.
Well, it really would have suited me, Joe, as I'd come all the way down tonight, but I guess they didn't consider me in all this. Dylan Connolly and Robbie Benson certainly didn't. When they combined for the equaliser very late in the game at about 3 minutes to go, Dundalk owned the ball in the second half and Cork City dropped back, didn't make substitutions, and they looked visibly tireder and tireder as the game went on. Connolly, who's a very quick player and very skillful as well, good to pick a pass, got in on the right-hand side, put a cross in, which kind of bobbled across the box, and it was one of those kind of slow matrix moments where things just don't seem to be happening at normal speed, and you could see Benson getting in. Well, we could all see it, but the Cork City defence obviously didn't quite spot him, or didn't spot him on time, and he just stuck his boot out and put it in, injured himself in the process. I mean, it was a really, 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 really tough moment for him, but yeah, he stuck it into the back of the net. The opening goal came after 20 minutes when a Buckley shot was saved by Rogers, horse slid in to get it away, and it came off Brian Gartland and into the back of the net. After that, three good chances for Cork. The best of them came to Keohane. Dooley, who was excellent all night, lifted the ball to him in the box. He kind of nearly looked over at the linesman as if to say, am I okay here? He said play on. Well, he didn't say play on, but he didn't pull up the flag. And Keohane showed a heavy first touch and then lifted it over the goalkeeper. And I thought to myself, that could be very costly. And then in the second half, obviously, Dundalk pretty much had City under the cosh for the entirety of it. Didn't create too many chances except for that goal and maybe a Michael Duffy shot. City did have the chance to steal it after that, across into Buckley, but he couldn't keep his header on target, and it ended 1-1. So City's title party, at the very least, delayed. Still 11 points between them with 4 games to go.
Okay, Oisin, super. Thanks very much, Oisin Langan at Turner's Cross this evening. 1-1 the final score. Short break. We're talking Liverpool. We'll hear what Jurgen Klopp had to say about things against Leicester. And Jack Pitt-Brook will talk to us about Slaven Bilic.
Off the ball
on News Talk,
in association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.
You're welcome, Max. Still 2-0 Arsenal, 79 minutes on the clock. We'll touch on Liverpool-Leicester in a moment, but interesting times for Slaven Bilic and West Ham. Spurs, although the scoreline suggested things were close, really outclassed them. Away from home, West Ham at home, very quiet.
Yeah,
spookily
definitely.
Quiet for chunks of this game. And Slaven Bilic's job is very much under pressure. He conceded as much himself and almost acknowledged he's in some kind of long kiss goodbye. He said, once the pressure's opened, then basically it doesn't stop. This was after the game against Spurs. Game by game, or two games by two games, it's the way it is in modern football. Once you open that page... .. We've got Jack Pitbrook of The Independent on the line. Evening, Jack.
Evening. How are you doing?
Very well. That page is well and truly open for Slaven Bilic at this stage.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of amazing that he's still there. Clearly, David Sullivan has decided that he's not the long-term man for the job. They started talking to other managers towards the end of last season. They spoke to David Wagner. They spoke to Marco Silva. Eventually, they didn't pull the trigger, basically, because Sullivan didn't want to pay off Bilic and his staff, which would have cost them just the best part of £3.5 million. And so we're left in this strange position, a little bit like Sam Allardyce was in his last season, where everyone knows that the manager's going to go, but Sullivan can't find anyone to replace him. And so he's still in the position, kind of seeing out his contract. It's not the sort of thing that would happen at any other club, I think.
It had seemed for a time like Bilic was really getting a tune out of West Ham and the players were responding to him and things were going well. I saw in your piece in The Independent, you made the point that the players do admire Bilic as a person and a mentor, but there is unease about a lack of a detailed, specific tactical plan, effectively.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, it's not that different from what happened with Croatia. Like, Bilic is such a great guy. Like, anyone who's spent any time with him knows that he's very interesting, he's funny, he's clever. He's charismatic. He can persuade the players of things. And that motivational power does get you quite far, like it did with Croatia when he took that job. And I think the first season at West Ham was a perfect example, particularly given the fact it was the last season at Upton Park. He did have a real grip over the players and it worked really well. And he got them to play above themselves every game. But that kind of thing doesn't last forever.
Mm.
And at the end of the day in the Premier League, you do need, you need an idea, you need a plan, you need some kind of basic tactics. It just isn't there with West Ham. Like, they are, they can get up for a big game every now and then, although they didn't really against Tottenham the other day, at least not until the last 20 minutes. But they don't have that structure and identity that you need in the Premier League.
Jack, the relationship between David Sullivan, David Gold and Slaven Bilic, it does seem now it is broken beyond repair, actually. But Is it just the compensation side why he's not going? Or I mean, and maybe just maybe I put park that as well for one. Is it the compensation? But also, the fact is that the point you touched on earlier on, when we see managers in this position, that negativity just spreads right throughout the club. So surely Gold and Sullivan have got to recognise this.
Yeah, you're right. I think it's not just the compensation. So West Ham did improve a little bit at the end of the last season, and they did actually beat Tottenham at home 1-0 in April. And that was a big part of, I think, convincing the West Ham board that maybe they should give Slaven a third season. But I think you're absolutely right that the negativity does spread. And I'd be really surprised if Bilic can successfully survive out the end of the season. Because I think, given the situation, you wouldn't be too surprised if the results start to tank and they have to get someone in as an emergency in January or February just to keep them up.
That's exactly the way it seems, though, doesn't it? It just seemed like that. That's the problem for them.
Kevin, your opinion, like, what's Bilic been working towards at West Ham? Like, what are they, a physical team? Are they a get-the-ball-to-Andy-Carroll team? Are they a bit-of-everything, bit-of-nothing kind of a team? I couldn't actually tell you what Bilic is working towards.
It's been a bit like that when Carroll's not been in.
Yeah.
It's been, wait for Andy Carroll to get back. As soon as he comes in, it's what I've seen of them, it's been lumping it forward, trying to get it into Carroll, trying to get him into the game and trying to feed off him, really. It's been a bit like that. He's changed from a three to a four. He's gone back to threes. He's altered his systems around perhaps probably Andy Carroll and his team. So it's almost as if it's all or nothing. Unless Andy Carroll plays, West Ham don't look threatening.
And Andy Carroll was chief architect of Spurs' win at the weekend as well.
Yeah, and he does come back from an injury. So he came on after 28 minutes and he did give them a bit of life, I suppose, in the second half. But take nothing away, Tottenham controlled this game. Tottenham should have been, before Serge Aurier was sent off, that this probably would have been 4-0 because they didn't look like they were in the game.
Carroll set up their goals
Yeah,
is the other problem. Like, Bilic has kind of been funny over the last couple of weeks, Jack. I think one of the great moments of all our lives is when he admitted that the Dildo Brothers line from the Sporting Lisbon chief or president about Sullivan and Gold was actually hilarious, and he had a good chuckle at that himself.
Yeah, I mean, that was without question the best thing to happen in the Premier League this season. I don't think he'll get bettered. I think that, yeah, like, I mean, the fact that he would be asked about it and the fact that he would say, yes, it was funny. And yeah. This is in the context of a press conference where he said that David Sullivan likes to talk in public about things. And this is part of a kind of fairly kind of silly, but also quite revealing back and forth spat, which started obviously with Sullivan saying that he tried to get Krychowiak from PSG and Renato Sanchez from Bayern, only for Bilic not to say that he didn't want them. So, like, it's a spat which shows you how broken down the relationship is between manager and chairman. I mean, you know, signings are very much another issue. Clearly, Bilic has got his own ideas. Sullivan has got his ideas. They've fallen out a lot on players. You know, people on the Sullivan side might say that, for example, Bilic turned down N'Golo Kante when he first got there, or that he turned down Kelechi Iheanacho from City this summer. I mean, there is fault on all sides, I think, when it comes to West Ham's transfers. But yeah, you're right. The Dildo Brothers stuff, as hilarious as it obviously is, does point to the fact that manager and chairman are now not averse to taking pops at each other in the press, which, while it's, you know, it's entertaining for us when that happens, it's not the sign of a healthy, well-run, functioning football club.
Jack, you spoke about them moving from Upton Park up to London Stadium there now. And when in that move, we probably assumed that West Ham would be seriously challenging the top six. We thought they'll have more revenue, more finances, more availability to go and get the better players around. It's just not happened. So where are West Ham? Where do you see them over the next 2 or 3 years?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think they need a bit of a relaunch with a new manager. You know, they need a manager who's got a much clearer idea of how he wants to play. I mean, first of all, they need to stay in the Premier League, because it's not certain at the moment they will. But once they do that, I think they need a kind of new, young, ambitious, hungry manager who can give them something to build around. Well, you know, Marco Silva would be great if they could get him, but I imagine he's probably now out of their reach. They could take a risk on someone younger from abroad. I'm sure they'd... Like, I think the problem with West Ham is they can get someone good. Like, you know, as you said, it's in London. They've got a big stadium. They've got a bit of money to throw around. So I'm sure it could be attractive to kind of Roberto Mancini-level managers. But I just don't think that Sullivan has got the clout to actually get a good manager in. And I think that lots of managers might take one look at West Ham and think, well, maybe that would be an attractive job. And then have a second thought and think, you know what, I'm better off where I am. Which I mean, for example, Rafa Benitez. Like, I'm sure, you know, Benitez wouldn't be averse to leaving Newcastle United at the moment, but would he really want to walk into West Ham?
Who wouldn't want to work for the Dildo Brothers?
Indeed not.
Jack, thanks so much for that. We'll see how it all unfolds.
Cheers, lad. Thanks a lot.
Jack Pitbrook there of The Independent, who writes great stuff on a host of different sports as well. So it just seems like it is the end of the road for Bilic. A very downtrodden crowd on Saturday. At one point, I thought my TV was on mute.
Yeah, it is. That's what you've found. I've not actually been to a game at London Stadium yet. Watched a lot of the games on TV, and a lot of the games, particularly these bigger games like this. I remember watching against Arsenal last season at home. Soon as the opposition scores against them, that's it. It's just flat, and it just seems dead in the stadium. You can pick that up from the TV. So a lot of problems there. Yeah.
Liverpool beat Leicester 3-2 in the end. Salah, who was really good for Liverpool up top with Firmino and Coutinho, he had a header from a Coutinho cross. That's his sixth of the season. Coutinho had the free kick. Leicester came back, corner, Mignolet made a mess of things, and then Henderson on the counter-attack. Sturridge set him up, and Henderson, in fairness, finished very well, and things got a bit scary for Liverpool towards the end. It went to 3-2 and there were free kicks laid on and all a bit messy. So somebody asked Jurgen Klopp, was your heart in your mouth towards the end?
My mouth was dry, but it was pretty much the whole game. My heart was okay. Sorry?
Injury time.
Who was injured? Yeah, I know. So that's that was really unlucky in this moment. But how is it? Everything good today and nobody has to worry about my heart. If anybody would worry about this, so
All good. Let's go home and prepare Moscow.
It's a turn of phrase. No, it's not suggesting anything's wrong with your heart. Heart in mouth means something else.
Oh, sorry.
Yes, no.
Maybe you should explain me then. Well, what means
maybe
it?
Maybe Jim should explain it. Yes.
Maybe Jim should explain. What does it mean?
Well, what's it meaning?
Hearts in mouth. But that means hearts in mouth. I know that you struggle with German sayings, yeah, but that's, that makes absolutely no sense for us, unfortunately. Yeah.
It doesn't make sense, really, does it? No. Totally spot there.
As he tried to work it out, he realised it was making no sense, and the press...
That's a friend of mine, Matt McCann, who's a press officer at Liverpool, yeah.
He was trying to say, it's a turn of phrase.
Yeah.
So Liverpool 3-2... Similar story, slightly unconvincing at the back. You joined the game at 2-0.
I watched
a bit of it.
2-0 Liverpool when I joined it. So I was, just got in, watched the whole of the second half. Liverpool, from what the guys were saying at half time, just controlled the match. They were totally in control of the game. And then all of a sudden, it's that switch that's within them. And you know, easily could have been 3-0. You know, the penalty from Vardy. Good save from Mignolet. Read it. He knew exactly what he was going to do. But Liverpool shouldn't be finding themselves in that position. They should be, and it's a constant theme. Mm. And we'll be talking about this again in the next few weeks. Why can't they sort that out? Because for how much they controlled that game, to concede the two goals, probably should have conceded three. And all of a sudden, then Klopp's under pressure again. He's getting asked a different sort of question after the match.
Yeah, I'm a fan of Danny Murphy.
Yeah,
unashamed fan of Danny Murphy. I think he's an excellent pundit. You can tell him I said that if you see
him.
All right,
I'll say that.
He had thought a very interesting piece on Jamie Vardy's penalty taking technique, which I hadn't really realised before or kind of seen it before, but he picked out various Vardy penalties over the last couple of months on Match of the Day, and he made the point that Vardy is looking at the ball too early in his run up. So effectively from when he does his little, you know, he kind of trots on the start on the spot as he's starting his run up. There's a little kind of Fred Flintstone kind of twinkle toes, and then starts the run. Pretty much from when he starts that, he's staring at the ball.
Yeah.
And Murphy's argument, he showed various Vardy penalties. And Murphy's argument was, you know, we're professional footballers. He doesn't need to look at the ball that early, and he could really improve things by actually seeing what the keeper's up to. Quite often, a keeper will take a step. Murphy said he's taking penalties. Keeper takes steps all the time. You have more information to work with.
Totally, yeah. And I think from Mignolet's point of view as well, when he's lining up for that penalty, he's obviously watching him. And if you saw the graphic that was on BT during the game as well, they showed exactly where his penalties had gone, where he'd hit the penalties, all in a very similar sort of area, exactly where the penalty that was taken at the weekend was saved. You'll know yourself, anyone can maybe, if you close your eyes and imagine that you're going to go and strike a ball, and you're going to go and strike it with your head down, you're just concentrating on the strike. If you're a right footer, the ball is automatically just going to fall to the left-hand side, exactly where it went. If I was a left footer, it'd be me just automatically going to the right-hand side, ever so slightly, if you're looking to get a clean strike on it. Mignolet doesn't need to do a lot of homework to recognise that that's what he does. And to be fair to him, you've got to, like most keepers do, go and watch it, got to see what he's going to do. But it just turned out exactly the way that Mignolet thought. But that's in my head. If I was in goal there and I've seen him do that, that is exactly where the ball would go. If you're going to strike it as true as you're going to try and strike it.
Would you keep your eyes on the goal and the goalkeeper for the first few steps of your run-up?
Yeah, I would have done, yeah. Certainly a couple of looks anyway. Quick look, and then obviously you're concentrating on your strike. Mm. I'm no penalty expert, as you know, Joe, but let's not go there again. But either the ones you would have taken and gone with, if I've gone for power, whatever I'm going to go and do, you still, even in that moment, you're looking, couple of looks, and on your run up, then you're concentrating on what you're going to do.
Not head down, run.
No, certainly not. Yeah. No.
Okay, Arsenal 2-0 up, 93 minutes on the clock. So Arsenal, for all the tragedy and hysteria around the place, are now 1 point behind Spurs in the table this evening. We'll take a short break.
Off the ball.
On News Talk.
In association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.
West Ham way text alert, Kev.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Hi, guys. I'm a West Ham fan for 55 years. Ooh, do the maths there. Does 55 get him back to 66? Doesn't quite.
No.
No, it doesn't.
No.
Very sad to see, says Eugene. our West Ham fan for 55 years, what Gold and Sullivan have done to our club, our great club. If Bilic is going to be dumped, we need to find a hungry young manager who can play the West Ham way.
It does get him back to 66, sorry.
It does?
Yeah, just about though, yeah.
Just about. You wouldn't have strong memories of it?
No, okay. Probably not.
And Eugene in Belgrade says, what about Tim Sherwood?
What about him?
We will move on. Okay, so PSG, we've talked to Philippe Auclair a few times about the situation and PSG.
It just seems to gather more momentum, this story, doesn't
it? Cavani and Neymar are rowing, or really it seems Neymar and his crew are ostracising Cavani, and it doesn't seem like Unai Emery, the coach, is going to necessarily go against his new star, €220 million signing, and Cavani seems to be in trouble here. So what seems to have happened, reports in Spain, which PSG have denied, the initial reports were that Cavani will be given €1 million to let Neymar take penalties.
Yeah. That's his top scorer bonus. If Cavani finishes top scorer at the end of the season, he gets €1 million.
Right.
It seems like we're giving you that anyway. You can have it. Doesn't matter whether you're top scorer or not, but we want Neymar on penalties.
Okay.
And, well, as we said the other week, it just comes back. Does it come down to the original one? There's only one winner here. Mm. This sounds ridiculous. This is as crazy as it's probably got, really. This is just modern football gone mad.
Emre said, there are two players able to take penalty kicks, Cavani and Neymar. There will be, from now on, the first shooter and the second shooter. I will let them know who is going to be the first one and who will be the second one. There is also a responsibility level. It's not the same thing when you're winning 3-0 and when the score is nil all. I didn't speak only to Cavani and Neymar, but the whole squad about the penalty issue. We wait to see what happens when PSG get their next penalty.
Yeah, PSG Bayern. Is that tomorrow? Wednesday, I think it is. PSG Bayern. I mean, it's a great game, but these are the sort of little things that happen within teams that can derail what can be such a good thing watching them this season, because they've got such good players. Probably better than Bayern Munich as they are now with that squad of players. We're set up for a really good game.
Mm.
But this is the sort of thing where the German mentality within them the other night in this game, think, oh, come on, let's just get into them. Let's get them rattled a little bit here. Let's see if we can get around and about this mob. And, you know, it might be nothing, this. It might be a total false story, but you can see something in it.
Mm.
You can see something that they need to react to this one. Mm. And I don't think Unai Emery's coming out with this with any sort of real credit for how he's actually acting and what he's saying in his press conferences.
Yeah. So Champions League is this week. United, Liverpool, both in action. We'll be coming to that across tomorrow and Wednesday. Earlier on, we asked you to identify this angry sports person.
You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious. That ball was on the line. Chalk flew up.
It is, of course, John McEnroe. Congratulations to Liam Hickey. You've won yourself, Liam, €250. And you're also in the running to win our end-of-week prize, €2,000. If you missed out tonight, we'll give you another chance to win tomorrow night. All with thanks to the new limited edition Angry Whopper Burger Range coming to Burger King this week. We're pretty much done for this evening. We'll have a busy show tomorrow as well, Champions League and a few other bits and pieces. And that is us done. You can podcast all of tonight's stuff. Robert Klemko on the NFL story. We covered the Dublin win yesterday against Mayo. And if you're just tuning in, football show as usual, available for podcast. Tom Dunn on the way next. Good luck.
Off the ball.
On News Talk.
In association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.